What is really going on, crypto savages? You are listening to the Coin Spice podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at coinspice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
Yes, indeedy. This is C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief out of coinspice.io, welcoming all crypto savages to the inaugural Coin Spice podcast. You might be thinking to yourself, wait, you did like 30 episodes with the milk thing or the soothing cryptos. Right. Look, I'm taking advice from Oprah and Gail and RuPaul. New year, new me, changing, turning over a new lease. There's lots of leaves involved. I'm not going to get into my artistic choices, okay? In any case, it has nothing to do with search engine optimization and making sure we get more clicks back to the... Nothing. In any case. Inaugural episode of the Coin Spice podcast is with the new editor-in-chief of The Block. You may have, chances are, if you're into crypto at all, stumbled across a Block article. They are a fantastic team, an incredible collection of reporters led by publisher Mike Dudas. They have essentially made a gigantic, presence known in less than a half a year. So I'm thinking maybe 5 months-ish, already kicking much ass. Always something interesting to read. And as I'm sure you also know, the current state of cryptocurrency journalism is awful. It's terrible. It's mostly, press release rewrites, very little, gumshoe investigative stuff, poorly written, on. The Block is trying to stop that, or at least trying to kind of bring everybody's game up professionally, and I think they're doing that. They've had some fits and starts, which we've documented out of CoinSpice, a couple blunders here and there, but, really, it's a clean format. They're fast, man, are they fast. They usually get things right. They've got a pretty good batting average right now. And there's also some really interesting investigative stuff going on over there. Anyway, I'm a fan. I'm a reader. It is definitely mandatory reading, even though they're competition. I decided to get John Biggs, who has been plucked personally by Mike Dudas and The Block, to run the organization. And I think you're going to really like the episode, our inaugural one here, with Mr. Biggs. He was kind enough to come on the show and kind of let us know his background, the general state of things in crypto as he sees them, and where the Block's going to be headed in the near future. Good episode. Lots of fun to listen to. Thanks for hanging in there with this silly little theme change. Other than that, it's, we're still keeping it spicy. Without any further ado, here is John Biggs, new editor-in-chief of The Block. How did you find cryptocurrency, maybe Bitcoin specifically, or however you got into it?
There's plenty of behind-the-scenes stuff that's changed in terms of programming, in terms of the way we build stuff. I was a big proponent of hardware startups before they were big, et cetera, et cetera. Anything that kind of changes the status quo is deeply important to me, because that's essentially what I'm trying to cover. That's essentially what I'm trying to look at.
And the journalism side seems to have come last in your professional development. I see that you were a programmer. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I went to Carnegie Mellon for information systems. And back then, information systems was basically going into a place and saying, well, you need 3 Oracle databases and 5 Spark servers.
Right.
And if you don't spend $12 million on all this hardware, you're not going to be able to have your people clock in with by typing something in on a keyboard. And it was just at the cusp. It was just at the cusp of that change that we started learning how to use all these open source tools. We started learning how to use the web. We started learning how to build products that iterated quickly. And a lot of the folks that I graduated with are still using and building on the products that they built in school. which is fascinating because you were basically, you're what, 21 or something like that. You made something for a project in school, like quite literally a senior project, and you could build a business on it. And we didn't think about it in terms of startups back then. We just thought we were a little bit smarter than the folks who were stuck in a cubicle somewhere. But then eventually they stuck us in cubicles to fix the Y2K problem. And then coming out of that, I realized that I would much rather work on 500 things a year than work on one thing for 5 years. And I got into journalism. So I was one of the few business journalists who actually have a background in information systems and computers. There are plenty of folks who are basically ex-scientists or ex-economists, etc. But nobody out there, I don't think, except for maybe Joel Johnson and a couple other folks,
right,
can basically just code up a Perl script.
And I think that comes across in your writing, especially with TechCrunch. You seem to or have been able to, I guess, sort of straddle that line between the geekier, pointy-headed side of things and also being able to convey it to, or whatever idea you're trying to push across to the hoi polloi. So I think that's a real advantage. So going back a little bit to the Carnegie Mellon thing and seeing how people were sort of groping at what this thing would become, do you find any parallels there with cryptocurrency?
I think the biggest parallel is Linux. I distinctly remember there was a guy on a plane. I think I was flying to Budapest or something like that. There was a guy on a plane, and he said that he was going to be installing a web server for these guys in Budapest. And he had the Sun server in his bag. He was literally carrying a server with him. And that was the only way to get a web server spun up in Budapest. You had to fly in from outside, out of town. And you would install it and hope for the best. And if you had to do any management, you flew around. So I remember the days of going into a server farm and sitting next to the rack that I had rented with a buddy of mine and sitting in the cold room and just on a console trying to fix this server. And for us to think about it these days is completely ridiculous, but now that's the way you used to have to do it. And the important thing is that all the stuff that server would do back then, especially that Sun server that guy was carrying around, can be done in about 5 minutes by spinning up an instance, a Docker instance, or even just a whole virtual machine, and getting it all done remotely.
Yeah.
And so we've changed the way we manage our servers. We changed the way we manage our applications. We changed the way we manage all sorts of things, thanks to a few important changes that happened in about 93 to 97 that nobody was looking at. Everybody was looking at Linux like it was some kind of, I don't know, hobbyist toy, and nobody got fired for installing Microsoft. Now you literally get fired for installing Microsoft because it's in its current incarnation, it's gotten a lot better. But for a little while there was really no reason to install NT server when you could basically spin up a couple Linux machines that had load management and all that other good stuff. So we're in that same position. We're in a position where nobody knows what to do with this stuff. Everybody knows that there's some benefit to it. There's some value to it. There's some people who are kind of dedicated to finding that value. There are plenty of people who are willing to put lots of money into shysters who want to lie about their ability to activate that value. And that's exactly what's happening right now. And that's what happened back then. You had people who said, look, we can ship pet food from the internet. And everybody said, pet food on the internet, that's amazing. But they didn't realize all sorts of other stuff, logistical stuff that needed to be managed on the back end of that, that pressing the buy button was the easiest part. Getting that pet food to somebody's house was the hardest part. And it's been fixed. It's been fixed because all the tools that made the buy button easy to work, easy to use, made the rest of the stuff easy to use.
And then so how do you, and that's a brilliant way to put it, how do you eventually stumble across cryptocurrency then?
Cryptocurrency was the closest thing to those heady days as we have right now. Nobody knows what to do with this stuff. It works in a very, very specific way, and you can send money, you can send value. But the people who are involved in it are either lying to you or so deluded that they don't understand what they have. So one of the things that I'm trying to do at the block is to try to move us away from being enthusiasts of the space and actually critics and appreciators of the space. Being an enthusiast is one thing. Being an enthusiast means that you hang out on the forums and you say that KDE is better than GNOME. You just yell about that all day long, and that's your hobby, and God bless you. But
that's not journalism.
There's no startup can be built out of that argument. So what's happening here is no business is going to be built out of that argument. What you can build out of that argument is a understanding of the space that can allow you to say to somebody who doesn't know anything about it, to say, go use KDE because it's really good. And while you're at it, we can make your entire, we can create a Internet of Things for you in a few minutes, and let's get it done. So until the space stops talking to itself, until the space stops yelling at itself, I'm talking about crypto specifically,
sure,
Nothing's going to get done. And there is precedent for that happening. There is precedent for the nerds just shutting up and building.
Super interesting. And so did you begin with Bitcoin in 2011? Did you get some, did you use it at all? Did you get sort of caught up in the hype at all?
I didn't get up caught up in the hype. I bought a few Bitcoin and I had a little mining rig under my desk, that was running for a while. It ran, I think I was getting 25 cents a day, then 25 cents a month. And then it was essentially, a space heater. So,
yeah. And so now, moving, you went then into journalism, I guess pretty formally as the East Coast editor of TechCrunch. And does Mike come to you, or were you reading the block? It's only been around for like 4 months, I guess. So
yeah, I mean, so Mike came to me a couple months ago, and he was like, "Come be the editor in chief," and I said no. And there's a reason. It was primarily because I wasn't into, again, I didn't want to head a enthusiast media site. I had seen what those were, and I'd seen the ending of those things, and they just never, there are plenty of places where you can get your back rubbed by a cool friend. And that's called Reddit and a couple other places. But for somebody to actually investigate and to say, look, this isn't working, is an entirely different thing. And I was watching them, and I would get the newsletter every day, and every couple of days I'd see a headline that I really, really liked. And it was quite clear that somebody was thinking on the same wavelength. And now that I realize, it's the entire team's thinking on that wavelength, including Dudas. So finally I said, all right, let's give it a try. I came on a consulting basis, and then I just basically flipped the switch because there's no reason not to. This is as exciting as TechCrunch was back in 2006 when we were first starting over there.
Wow. And you guys are primarily based out of New York. Is that right?
Yeah. Most of the folks are in New York. There are two folks in Europe, actually three folks in Europe, and another guy in Denver. And we're trying to build a remote team. I've worked remotely for 18 years. So to put me into an office is a dangerous thing. So we're trying to, that's actually the best way to do it, because this is a 24-hour job. There's actually no way to go to sleep here. So we have to figure out how to spread the work out.
Yeah, that is for sure true. Crypto does not sleep at all, ever. And there's always something going on. You wrote kind of an introductory piece to The World, as the new EIC of the block. And that was a real interesting, it almost veered off into quasi-manifesto, quasi-mission statement. Mm-hmm. There are at least two types of editors-in-chiefs, and you may be a third. The first is the guy or gal who cannot get out of her own way, right? So she is constantly out in front and sort of becomes the project, for better or worse, and usually worse. Mm-hmm. And then there's the gal or guy who's head down, you just don't even know they exist. And then you kind of come out, again, I didn't even realize how much I had read your stuff until I started looking into it. You sort of seem to be in between there and more towards the head down side, but you did come out with a rather lengthy, hey, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. What prompted you there?
Because I wanted to lay the ground rules. In many cases, the ground rules weren't laid because you basically had a site that just started organically out of, I don't know, somebody wanted to do some kind of affiliate marketing and it just got popular. So we're in a position to start something new and journalistic, right out of the gate. So my mission on that was to explain, look, we're not your friend. I don't think PR people are my friends. I don't think, founders are my friends. Sure, I have friends who are founders, but in this very specific interaction that these folks want and need to have with the world, we're far better off being impartial observers who will work with you on a story, if there's something interesting to share with our readership. I don't want to get all amorosa on this whole thing, but it's kind of rough because you basically go native is what happens. And I've seen this again and again and again and again, with gadget coverage, with tech coverage, et cetera. There's a lot of San Francisco folks.
You just get sucked in.
Yeah. You get sucked in. You're within that world. And your buddy says, hey, this is happening. And what happens there is that buddy may have ulterior motives for telling you that information. Maybe they want to improve their chances of getting a round or something like that. They say, these guys suck. Incidentally, we're really cool. So let's figure out the story that says that. And that's really dangerous because everybody should have a level playing field. There should be everybody with an idea from here to Belarus should have a fair shake. And that's actually not true in the startup world. And it's really, really unfair. And that's one of the things that I've always been trying to solve here.
Wow, that is super interesting. And how does the block make its money?
I'm not exactly sure yet. We have to figure that out. No, we're going to be selling subscriptions over the next few months, premium subscriptions. So a lot of the content that's coming out that I really fell in love with is going to be behind a paywall. And look, one of the biggest things that I personally caused, and I'm going to say this, and I know this sounds like, hey, I'm taking I'm on the cross here, but my cohort of bloggers, we said to the world, here is 40 posts detailing every single thing that happened in the gadget world today. 40 posts, take them for free, do what you want with them. Yell at us for getting things wrong, even though we have to sit here and bust our asses to make sure that you guys have content all day long to feed your hunger. And here, take it for free. And what did that get us? That got us BuzzFeed with the listicle. That got us fake news sites that look like blogs, because we basically said to the world, this information is as valid as New York Times's information. And in fact, because we destroyed a lot of magazines, we created an environment that said magazine information is no longer valid. So what I want to do is I want to right that wrong here. And there has to be a better way to manage content. And this is one of them. I would argue that the subscription is the most primitive and the primitive way of doing it, which is fine for now. There's one thing that I was working on before I started the block. It was called Hype Hop, which basically... Right. It's sort of a sponsored video. You basically get on there and you can get like 44 cents to view a ICO video. So instead of forcing people to watch your video while they're watching a duck fall into the water on Facebook, you basically go into a interaction with that person. You say to that person, here's a video. I want you to take a look at it. We're going to pay you to watch it. And I want to make sure that you pay attention. So we have a few tools to do that. I think that's the future of content, because the ability to ensure that somebody's paying attention to your message is of utmost importance to the marketers. And sponsored posts make everybody look bad. It makes the reader feel like they're being cheated. It makes the marketer feel like that they're buying eyeballs, and it makes the content provider look cheap, that they would give away their space for free. They're editorial for free. So let's fix that. This is the first step. Again, the subscription is a hammer to this problem. There has to be a fine screwdriver that we can figure out as well.
Wow, that is super, super fascinating. So the model maybe going forward is to somehow weave into the block a subscription model or a paywall. Now there's actually, you know, some precedents for this. I want to say Wall Street Journal, and they kind of survived, you know, to greater or lesser degree, with more success. I'm finding a hard time to a hard way to mm-hmm. to put this. They sort of survived and were able to put out, I mean, they had to trim the size of the journal, all that good stuff, but they managed to keep going when pretty much everybody else was falling off or, you know, whatever. And mm-hmm. they were widely derided for doing so. So now I think more content providers are looking, you know, like you say, they're trying to find that, that sweet spot between all those tensions. So it's the future for writing of your kind, right? So writing that purports to be objective. Is it a constant struggle to fight against biases?
It's not a constant struggle if you're an actual journalist. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of those. Over at our team, we have plenty of those folks, and I'm really happy that they're there. I think also the idea of bias is a construct that gets stuck in people's heads just because they get because they read something that they don't like. So the idea of bias is incorrect in this case. It's basically just something that you're upset about because you're just upset. So for example, you'll get people talking or yelling at us on Twitter or whatever, and that's another big issue. The talkback is mostly the loudest people in the room who are the grumpiest people in the room. So it's never really a representation of what people actually think. But we'll say, look, you're biased against Ethereum. And like, look, it's a piece of code. Well, I'm not going to be biased against that. It's the same argument as KDE versus GNOME. If you want to sit there in your forum, if you want to sit there in your room, and you and your buddies can yell about it all day long, then that's absolutely perfect. But don't bring the rest of the world into this. If one of the things that I always, one of the people who I always wrote for, was my dad. He had a master's in English. He had some technical background. He made his own Heathkits back in the day, all this other good stuff. But he wasn't really a technical guy. But I tried to explain things in a way that he would understand them. And the reason why I did that is because I knew out there were millions of folks like my dad who grew up in a non-technical world, who are being thrust into this world, and the better they understand it, the easier it's going to be for them to manage it. And the vast majority of cases right now, you're seeing the results of what happens when you don't write for the older generation, all the fake news stuff and everything. But at the very least, I hoped I could, I hope I was able to change one or two points of view. I want the block to be for a couple people. I want it to be a guy like me who knows this stuff fairly deeply and broadly and can understand it. I want it to be for the guy on Reddit who's yelling about what kind of commenting styles should be done in the Ethereum source code. And I also want it to be for the dentist in Gun Barrel, Colorado, who has a couple little bit of money to invest and is trying to figure out how to do it. He wants to invest in a startup. Can I trust an STO? Can I trust this startup to exist? Thus far, nobody's proven themselves out, and we have to tell that guy that. Look, you can give this a try. It's dangerous. You might make a lot of money. You might not. But it's worth watching, right? So let's get everybody watching this space. I tell all the writers there's a bullseye of audience. We're always going to get the bullseye. We're always going to get the small group of people in the middle who are completely dedicated to this. And as soon as they see the word blockchain or Bitcoin, they're going to click and yell and whine and whatever. Then there's a little further outside is sort of the enthusiast who understands but isn't quite that obsessed. And then the rest of the dartboard, where you would get the lowest scores on a real game of darts, are the folks who is the wide range of people who you can access and tell the story to. And you can convert them. You can convert them to get closer and closer and closer to the center. You get your diehards that way. You don't get your diehards by supporting every whim of the chattering class.
Mm. Yeah, and I've noticed that even, you know, like you say, you've been consulting for a little while at the blog. I've noticed that trend there. It has become mandatory reading. It's something that I get up as I start my day, and I've got you guys open. I'm reading. I'm seeing what's going on. You got the basic, like you say, those three foundational readers, for lack of a better phrase, who you're appealing to, and I can see in the quick news ideas, the editorials, and that's what I also appreciate about it too is the presentation, that it really is straight, no chaser. There's not a lot of bells and whistles. You know, you can scroll down easily, get the source. You guys break stories, but you also reprint them. And you know, there's a lot of good editorial content there. Some investigative stuff that has just really blown my mind. So let's just end this now with kind of your staff. You guys, I noticed the block right away a few months back when I guess Mike picked off Frank, right? Frank Shaparro?
Yeah, it's Frank Shaparro. Frank Shaparro, we've got Larry Chernock, he's great. Isabel Woodford. We have a new woman, Carol Gaunch, who's on. She's writing the smaller stuff. We just hired Chris Nisi, who is who used to be my copy editor over at TechCrunch. Now he's managing editor over here. We have Tio, Mateo. We have Steven and Ryan. Ryan was over at Consensus. Basically, it's a bunch of really, really dedicated people who really love this space, and they can really talk about all kinds of stuff. And we have Arjun, who's our who's sort of our guru, who hangs out, Arjun Balaji, who hangs out in the background and says, "Hey, this is not technically correct," which is vitally important. I mean, one of the things that's slowest about this is that everybody checks in with everybody else, and that's great because it's a team. Everybody says, "Hey, can you make sure that I'm not making stuff up here?" And everybody has something to say about this very, very technical topic. If there are technical deficiencies, I'm definitely coming at it from a technical efficiency. I know it from a high level, but I don't know I haven't coded it yet. And everybody fixes each other, and that's great, and that's the way it has to be. One of the things that's most frustrating is that you have some guy who's on a pedantic rant about one point of a story that's completely right. And that's kind of drives me crazy. And again, that's the folks in the forums. And maybe at some point that chatter, maybe that back and forth isn't going to matter. Just as it doesn't really matter if I want to spin up an e-commerce site. Do I need to use Docker? Do I need to use Kubernetes? Do I need to program in JavaScript or Perl or PHP? Doesn't matter. I figure out what I want to use and I use it, and I go into a room somewhere on Stack Exchange, and that room doesn't say you're an idiot for using PHP or you're an idiot for being into Bitcoin Cash. Instead, that room says, here's how to fix this stuff. Let's go for it. And that's the way this environment and that's the way this ecosystem has to grow. And that's what we're trying to do.
It is definitely a maturation process. And 10 years in, we can start to see the wheat and the chaff and everything sort of separating now. Well, I've already taken up too much of your time. Let's end it here. You're forward looking. Are you bullish on the space? Do you see cryptocurrency and all of its ancillaries being a huge deal in the future, or are you sort of agnostic?
I'm bullish as you can be given the current state of things. I think what we're seeing now is quite literally the dot-com crash of about 2000. This is all the stuff that I talked about before came to a head. The idea that you don't need to buy any more hardware anymore. You don't need to buy specialized hardware. And that happened in 2000, right after Y2K. People bought all kinds of garbage and they didn't need, and they realized that they got fooled. and they fought back. And that's exactly what happened. So we're in the same situation. We're in a position where lots of people bought all kinds of stuff that they didn't need. And they're realizing that now. And the people who promised them the world essentially can only offer a dimly lit basement. And until that gets fixed, this industry and this ecosystem can't thrive. I think it is getting fixed. And I think some of the folks that we're talking to right now, especially on the block, are fascinating, and they're really thinking in different ways. But when a place like Coinbase, for example, is the number one startup in the entire space, I don't think you can name another one that is quite as well funded and quite as well as doing quite as well in terms of UX, UI, user experience, and usability, and I guess trustworthiness thus far. When there's only one of them out floating around, then that's a problem. And I think that's going to get better.
Very good. Well, everybody, this was John Biggs, the new editor-in-chief out at the block. It's just a fantastic resource. I'm sure everybody at least is relatively familiar with it. But now you've got even more reason to get out there and support the project. Best of luck, man. I am rooting for you guys. And thanks again for coming on.
All right. Thank you a lot.